The new year brings about many thoughts. These particular thoughts, though, were inspired by regular listener Sort Baker in the Netherlands. Since meeting him in Farnborough, July 2016, Sort and I continued to be in touch through Twitter and the Airline Pilot Guy podcast chat room. He works with the Dutch Dakota Association, also known as DDA Classic Airlines, or just DDA. If things go as planned, sometime soon, DDA will be bringing a DC-3 back to life to become a sightseeing passenger airliner. Like the Wright Flyer, the Douglas DC-3 also first flew on December 17th, but 32 years later in 1935. It's amazing what happened in those three decades. The DC-3 had a cruise speed of 207 miles per hour, a range of 1,500 miles, a service ceiling of 23,200 feet, and a climb rate of 1,130 feet per minute. With those kinds of numbers, many say the DC-3 was the first real airliner, and it certainly revolutionized air transport. Now, of course, I have no doubt that you all remember that I have many favorite aircraft. Yeah, I'm fickle that way. My love of airplanes is Catholic. That's with a lowercase c. When used that way, the word means universal. But even with my Catholic taste and fickle nature, I must say that the DC-3, without a doubt, has been one of my true loves for over 50 years. I remember the first time I saw a DC-3. It was in the 1945 John Ford film, They Were Expendable, starring Robert Montgomery, John Wayne, and Donna Reed. Although I've got to say, my favorite actor in that film is Ward Bond. He's always been outstanding in just about everything he's done. Ford Apache, The Maltese Falcon, The Grapes of Wrath. No, but that's another story. Anyway, the first time I saw They Were Expendable, I must have been about 7 or 8 years old, and watched it, as I did many old films, with my father, Lou. At the end of the film, I saw a plane fly in to take Robert Montgomery and John Wayne to safety. The aircraft was sleek, twin-engined, looking like, as Max Flight once said, quote, just what an airplane should look like, unquote. It was love at first sight. I asked my dad, what kind of plane is that? He said, it's a C-47. My dad told me the C-47 was a cargo and troop-carrying airplane, and that while he was in theater in Europe, he flew on them many times. A few weeks later, my dad took me to the movies. Yes, we went out to the big screen together to see The Longest Day, a top-notch flick I highly recommend. The Longest Day was filled with C-47s. From then on, I was looking for C-47s in every film I ever watched. 3 or 4 years later, I was visiting my cousin Mitchell on Long Island in New York. He was in the Civil Air Patrol, and he took me to Islip MacArthur Airport to show me around. My Aunt Martha, Mitchell's mom, dropped us off at the airport and said she would be back to pick us up in a couple of hours. Back then, airports were pretty open spaces, and even kids like us could pretty much just walk out on the tarmac at any time. I remember approaching the flight line, and I saw, parked right in front of me, a C-47, the first one I ever saw in person. I said to my cousin Mitchell, look, that's a C-47, but he corrected me. No, he said, that's a DC-3. Mitchell took the time to explain the difference between a DC-3 and C-47, but it didn't matter to me. I was in love. We walked right up to it, got right under its nose and looked up. Remember, I couldn't have been more than 11 or 12 years old. I was a kid, and the plane looked immense to me. I remember Cousin Mitchell's words as he looked up with me. He said, look at all that surface area. We stood in front of that DC-3 for maybe 30 minutes, and spent the rest of our time there walking around it, inspecting it from nose to tail, wingtip to wingtip. The 2 hours we had at the airport felt like 10 minutes, and then it was time to go. I didn't get close to another DC-3 again for over a decade. This time it was in Athens, Ohio, at the Ohio University Airport. The avionics department at Ohio University had been gifted two DC-3s by the federal government. One was permanently grounded, but the other was flown as a test bed for electronics. I never got to see them while an undergraduate. I didn't have any way to get out to the airport. But when I returned to Athens, Ohio, as a graduate student, I would visit them regularly. If you go to a map and look at the area in and around Athens, Ohio, you can see that it's pretty much of a dead spot for aircraft. It would drive me nuts not being able to look up and see an airplane in the sky. It was a major event when one was visible. As a graduate student, about every 2 weeks, I would drive out to what was an almost deserted airport to visit the DC-3s. Most times they were locked up in their hangar, and I had to peek at them through a window. Occasionally, one would be outside, and I could walk right up to it. but once I was invited inside and got a chance to climb up into the cockpit. It was only for a minute, but what a thrill. A few years later, I took a job in Pueblo, Colorado. Part of my job responsibility was running a summer youth hostel and conference center. The location of this facility overlooked the Pueblo Memorial Airport, and it was wonderful for plane spotting. If you want to hear more about my experiences in Pueblo, check out my story, Pueblo, A Geek's Dream, which appeared on Airplane Geeks episode 313. Back then, the Pueblo Memorial Airport also played host to the Great Colorado Air Show at the end of every summer. I attended it one year with my father when he flew out from New Jersey to visit me. After that, I just watched the acts from my perch high on the hill that looked perpendicular to runways 8/26 and parallel to runways 17/35. One year, the conference center hosted a group of skydivers that were going to perform at the air show. They were a large group, and being the airplane geek I've always been, I befriended them, asked about their act, how long they were doing it, and what they would be jumping from. They told me they hired a DC-3 and it would be coming the next day. They invited me down to the airport to watch them dirt dive and do their practice jumps. I'd never seen anything like that before and was thrilled to take part, but what I really wanted was a ride in that DC-3. The pilot checked in the next morning. I was at the desk and made sure he got the best room we had. I told him what a fan I was of the DC-3 and that I would be coming down to the airport later in the day to watch dirt dives and practice jumps. I asked him if there was any chance I might be able to get a ride on the DC-3 during one of the jumps. His response? Well, come on down. We'll see what we can work out. I was ecstatic. Later that day, I went down to the airport and was welcomed by the group. I had no familiarity with skydiving. I was taught about dirt diving and watched everyone count down and roll around the tarmac on their bellies on wheeled carts. They would count down, start, count up, go into formation, count down again, and break off. Then the group would critique the dirt dive and try again. It went on for a couple of hours until they were ready to make a practice jump. Now I wish I remembered the pilot's name. I do recall he had an incredible number of hours in many different types and had a U.S. Air Force background. The way he looked, as well as the way he walked and talked, a modest yet swaggering style, he sort of reminded me of Sam Shepard. During the dirt dives, I checked in with him, asked what the chances were of flying in the DC-3. He said they looked pretty good, but he needed to check with the FAA inspector. I didn't know why a conversation with an FAA inspector was necessary. Still don't, for that matter. But when the inspector came along to check in and look at the aircraft, I do remember him asking the pilot if he had his own parachute. His exact words? You got a rig? The pilot picked up a black rig and walked with it to the aircraft as they went on the inspection tour. The inspector left, and the pilot said to me, "Not this time, but hang around. We should be able to get you on for the next jump." A few minutes later, the skydiving team climbed on board, and they took off for their first live practice of the day. It was just terrific to watch those engines start up from so close by, hear the roar of those Pratt & Whitney R-1830 twin wasps, and feel the breeze they kicked up. I watched them taxi out, take off, and climb. I lost sight of it for a while, but then the next time I saw it, it wasn't just it, it was them. That DC-3 looked like it was giving birth to 30 or so little ants as the skydivers jumped out and started their free fall. I was so enthralled with the skydiving that I lost track of the aircraft until it landed. The skydivers touched down, grabbed up their chutes, and came back to the practice area where they repacked and discussed the dive. Then they started dirt diving again, making corrections based on what happened in the air. They told me they would only be doing 2 or 3 dirt dives this time, and then go on another practice jump, their last for the day. Trying not to be a pest, but also not wanting to be forgotten, I asked the pilot what the odds were that I would be able to come along this time. He said he hadn't forgotten about me, but needed to run it by the FAA inspector when he returned. The conversation between the pilot and the FAA inspector was interesting, to say the least. The pilot pointed at me and said, "Can I bring him along in the right seat?" The inspector replied, "He got a rig?" The pilot said, "On the plane." And the inspector replied, "Okay." Well, that was great news. I was going to fly in a DC-3, in the right seat, no less. But I had no idea why I needed a parachute. In fact, I still don't. But I did know there was no parachute on the plane for me. I also knew that even if there was one, I had no idea how to put it on, let alone use it. No matter, I was going to fly in a DC-3. The pilot walked me over to the plane and got in with me close behind him. I walked up the incline to the cockpit and had to climb over a great big green oxygen bottle about 4 feet long and mounted lengthwise in the fuselage with a valve in the opening of the cockpit door. Attached to that valve were a bunch of hospital-style clear soft plastic oxygen masks connected with long clear tubing. It looked rather jury-rigged to me. Maybe that's what the FAA inspector had wanted to see. The interior of the DC-3 was hot. I mean, it had to be at least 95 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 35 Celsius. Remember, it was the middle of the afternoon in August in the high desert of Colorado. The pilot had his window open, and I slid mine back too, trying to catch what little breeze there might be. I was sweating like in a sauna, and was soaked with perspiration. The skydivers climbed on board, and the pilot began the startup procedures. He had me call clear out of my open window, and started the right R-1830. Then he started the left one. We taxied out and took off. The skydivers were packed in behind me like cattle. One of them, directly behind me, was fiddling with the oxygen, and within a few minutes he handed me a mask. It seemed a bit strange to be starting the oxygen so early in the climb, but then I remembered. We had a 5,000-foot head start. Pueblo was at 5,000 feet mean sea level. The other thing I realized, I was cold. The stiff breeze and the altitude had pretty much dried out my sweat-soaked shirt. I reached and closed a window. We climbed to about 20,000 feet. It was a long climb. Remember, the DC-3 has a service ceiling of only 23,200, and a climb rate is 1,130 feet per minute, so it took about 15 minutes to get to the drop altitude. I was breathing through the mask, happy to finally be flying in a DC-3 for my first time. We reached the drop point, and the pilot shouted, "Go!" The skydivers all started shouting, "Go! Go! Go!" And then they were gone. By the time I turned around to see them exit, the plane was empty. Before I knew it, we were in a steep banking dive to the right. I'd never been in a dive so steep before or since, and while I can't tell you how many degree bank it was, it felt like it was a really high angle. Between the excitement of being in a DC-3 for the first time, and the first time taking off with a group of passengers I wasn't landing with, combined with the steep dive and high bank angle, it all felt a bit dreamy to me. The pilot had put down his oxygen mask, and I wondered why, as I was still holding mine over my nose and mouth and was breathing through it. Like I said, it all felt like a dream. The next thing I knew, we were lining up to land, touched down, and came to what felt like a very quick stop on the runway. I commented on it to the pilot, and he said, "That's one of the beauties of the DC-3. What I didn't realize, though, not until I got off the plane, was that just before the skydivers jumped, they turned off the oxygen. That's why we made such a steep dive, to lose altitude quickly. And I mean quickly. That's also why it felt so dreamy to me. I must have been hypoxic. So my first and only flight in a DC-3 is just a memory, and a rather faded one at that. Some of that fade is due to time, but a good deal of it has to do with a lack of oxygen. Some 30-odd years later, I'm still in love with the DC-3. I guess I always will be. Maybe one day, I'll get a chance to fly in one, with enough oxygen in my system to sustain the memory of it. Until then, the dream and the reality of that wonderful flight, that one time back in Pueblo, Colorado, will just have to do. For Jetwine, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.